30, a program we operate is the Industrial Development Revenue Bond Program, in which the state authorizes a business to sell bonds, the interest on which becomes tax exempt. There's a lost tax revenue associated with that. But the cost-benefit analysis is such that the company has to demonstrate that it and its employees will pay enough additional taxes or have enough additional income that the taxes on that income will be more than the taxes forgiven. So a simple company-originated cost-benefit analysis that went to revenue, that targeted them, that here's a company we need to take a look at, have the computers watch even to see that there's an increase in payroll. Payroll, I think, is critical because the computers can do that. I was asked by Ann and if the department would be interested in having a role in this, and my answer is no. We really don't want to spend staff time certifying potentially thousands of businesses in the state that might qualify for this incentive. But if the businesses self-certify and we can create a simple-to-track mechanism that revenue can have their computers track, did payroll increase, for example? And then even maybe a fixed amount reimbursement so that you can make sure that the program is self-sufficient, that each employee who gets each new employee that's full-time, there's a change in the payroll, there's either X% of the payroll or X amount per employee that gets paid, and you make sure that that's less than the new income generated per the certification. I think there's some potential to go in that direction. These are just off the top of my head reactions, but I think you need to simplify it as much as possible so it doesn't become a big administrative sink. And I'd like to address certain numbers that we heard, and I don't want to take committee time necessarily, but I will if it's your pleasure. Otherwise, I'd be happy to meet with you individually to talk about some of those things. But some things become administrative sinks. We don't want this to do that if it is to happen. And you want to simplify it so that revenue doesn't have to do any more than they have to do.
I thank you for that thought, because that clearly is the direction I want to go. I want to create the least amount of administrative burden at every step of the equation.
Mr. Chair, if I may, you made another comment that triggered a thought, and again, a personal policy observation, and I don't want to second guess you guys. For businesses starting out, a concern first, and then I think a way to make things work a little bit better. A concern, Representative King talked about buying six Dairy Queens. It's conceivable that he could even buy those from himself, that he could be a private business, a sole proprietorship, then incorporate. We now have a new entity who's a new employer paying or applying for tax benefits for people that really work for Mr. King when he was Mr. King. Now he's Corporate King, the Burger King, I guess. So I think there are some concerns about new businesses that need to be addressed. But I think I witnessed, particularly in terms of another tax credit program run by a different agency, and I don't want to get too bogged down in their policy, but I've seen businesses that were willing to make improvements that would have accomplished the public benefit that was meant to be incented by the tax credit program. The business wasn't profitable or was only marginally profitable, so the tax credit was meaningless. In the old investment tax credit, there was a transferability of that tax credit so that primarily lending companies or lease companies became financiers. They, because they owned the equipment that was in which the new investment was being made, they earned an investment tax credit. They passed that along as a discount to the business that couldn't afford really to install the equipment, but you saw significant investment being incented by that third-party participation. It occurs to me that you could build in some transferability of the tax credit that would make it valuable to startup businesses, start for capital, trying to keep their doors open by encouraging deeper pockets to participate in their business in a constructive way.
That's an interesting thought. Representative King.
Right. I've seen that happen in practice where, in effect, the investment tax credit on machinery becomes the down payment, for the equipment, because the bank could use that more than the new operator. And, as we process this, it's a complex issue, and we just run into a lot of, well, what ifs and problems, and, you know, this is getting pretty heavy loaded. But, you know, you do have circumstances that are real clear cut when you work with local development parks or, you know, agencies that are the, you know, that doing the effort to attract new employers. And so we work all kinds of agreements out saying, you come here and we help you do this building, and but your deal is you have to put in 40 jobs, or, you know, something is building that contract. And you're monitoring that already, and somebody's out there monitoring, you know, that already. And those are the most pure and simple, clear new jobs, as versus all the gamesmanship that we're trying to avoid. But I'm not sure that you're ever going to get there on that, because, you know, there's more advantage to the loophole users than the loophole, you know, writer avoiders. So, you know, is there something, you know, that's potentially there, you know, in terms of helping the agencies that are already out there doing this, attracting something, so that if we're going to look at something along this line, that it'd be available for a year, but they have another year to get there, so that we've got something that's clearly identifiable and that it's clearly new jobs.
Chair, Representative King, I think transparency for the business is the most critical element. And you know, there's a lot of discussion now about the regulatory environment and streamlining the red tape there. I think most businesses are fine knowing that it's going to take them, they may not be happy with the fact that it's going to take them 2 months or 3 months to get to the end of the road, but knowing absolutely that if they go through these steps, in this timeline they'll get there, is usually enough for a business. So some sort of a mechanism that said, if you do these things, if your payroll increases by this amount, you talked this morning about percentage thresholds for increase, you know, you said 10% or 15%, if you get to those levels, you will earn a tax credit equal to this much per employer, such a percentage of your payroll. I think businesses will jump through hoops that get them to that. I think the certainty is more important than the specifics of the steps. And I think whatever you do, you want to be pretty black and white about who gets this and what it takes to get to it. If you do that, I think we'll have businesses who, you know, everything we do, the Economic Community Development Department, is on the margins. Businesses aren't going to make decisions to expand because of this program. But if there's a business that's making a decision that's kind of on the edge, that, you know, well, yeah, this might work, you know, maybe we should invest in the new piece of equipment and go for it. We think that the economy's turning around and it's time to bite the bullet and get rolling. And if we do, we're going to get this thing that changes the bottom line to the point where, and even if it's only for 1 year, the Enterprise Zone program is a 3-year program in essence. When you do present value computations, which is what you do when you consider investments, the first year is the most important year. 3 years is great. But you change the numbers dramatically to something you can do right up front out of the box. And so to the extent that you have some definition and a clear black and white go or no-go, simple process, I think you'll see businesses who are on the edge, who are considering an investment that otherwise might not make sense, step across the line and pony up.
Mr. Speer.
Yes. Mike, if I heard what you said, the KISS formula, keep it stupid, or keep it simple, stupid, if the scenario was like that you would earn a tax credit that was based upon a payroll increase tied to a living wage, whatever that amount is, $30,000 a year, and if you increase your payroll by $30,000 a year, you would be entitled to a definite amount of tax credit. And if it was a new business startup that you could accumulate and earn those tax credits and maybe carry them forward into profitable years, maybe 5 years down the road, would something like that work?
Chair Kraft, Representative Brown, I'm going to get into personal policy here again. My rural bias is that living wages are an urban bias, that there are places in Oregon where we still have double-digit unemployment, and you know that very well. Those of you from the coast know it particularly well, over eastern Oregon. But there are places where the market doesn't demand $15 an hour jobs. There are places in the state where the market does demand $15 an hour jobs, where minimum wage is meaningless because you can't hire people for that. And there are even places where it's seasonally true that you can't get people who you need for that. I think, and to get to a point Representative Lowe made earlier, for some people, a half-time job works. Or even just a summer job works. They're going to school, but they need a job during the summer, and then they need part-time after that. We had a policy discussion inside the agency this week about what's a good job and whether or not the agency should be really taking a position on that. My rural Oregon bias, when there used to be family wage standards that said you don't qualify for this program unless you're paying family wage, and originally family wage was defined on a statewide level, was that you took Lake County, the county where I was working, out of consideration because the largest employer in Lake County is the Forest Service, and they pay a different pay scale than the people we're talking about here. The next largest employer was the BLM, and the next one was the school district. When you took out public employment in Lake County, family wage standard dropped $1 an hour. We're talking, these kind of incentives work with entry-level jobs. They're not the people at the top of the heap. They're not the people that are getting paid the big bucks. So I'm concerned about defining a good job. I think people need to do that on their own. It's kind of why I like payroll. The bottom line for the state is, did we increase the payroll? Are there, whether it's two people making $7.50 an hour or one person making $15 an hour, depending on those folks and their circumstances, my son, my 22-year-old son, right now would be happy with $7.50 an hour, 40 hours a week. And I couldn't get by on that. So a good job is variable. I think we need to figure out what is good policy for the state, and a threshold that says you meet this level. Maybe it's tied to the unemployment rate. Maybe it's tied to how high unemployment is in the county that we're talking about. Maybe it's a different standard than it is in Portland or Eugene or Corvallis. It's my standard case in point since I grew up there. I hope that gets to your question.
You need some way to determine the dollar amount so that so if it's $15,000, they earn one credit. If they've increased it $30,000, they've earned two credits, or whatever that dollar figure amount that you came up with, and that represents creating one job.
Chair Puff, Representative Brown, that's exactly. I think that's would be an excellent approach if you decided to go down this road. I think I don't want to throw a blanket on this, but I think there's a lot of issues here, and like I said, it's been on my mind now for about 5 hours. So I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but it seems to me that there might be some potential here, and if you can sort through that stuff. I've, in order to get at the tax increment element, I've tasked our economists with spending some time trying to, with employment and legislative, Paul Warner, trying to get a handle on, whether there is a tax increment here that would make this a self-funding program. And, maybe you come up with a number that equates to one job, and you get twice that, you get two credits, like you're suggesting.
Yeah, the benefit of increasing the extra job may not only be the additional income tax dollars that you're creating there for a revenue for the state, but it may also be reducing the unemployment cost if that person happens to be going unemployment.
Point. Let's talk about that further. I think that's where this situation. Any additional questions for Mike?
Mike, thanks. I appreciate it very much.
Sure.
Sorry to drag you over here so early this morning. I appreciate your responsiveness and willingness to come up and share your thoughts.
Chair Kraft, members of the committee, thank you for offering me the opportunity to testify, and I would really love to talk with each of you about certain numbers that were reported earlier on. So maybe after the special session or even if you get a break.
Okay.
Give me a call.
Members, do you want a quick break or do you want to go ahead and run through our audience? Okay. But why don't we go ahead and get started. Tim, you're first on the list. Tim Nesbitt, and then Harvey Matthews, you're next. And we'll have Joe Gilliam and J.L. Wilson. Tim, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the AFL-CIO in Oregon. Just a comment right to the central purpose of the bill, which is to create new jobs. I can't think of a better purpose for any tax credit than job creation, unless it's good job creation, which we are willing to define, but that's the topic for another day. However, are concerned that this bill, as currently drafted, even with the dash one amendments, has the central problem of any policy that attempts to create incentives for a particular behavior, whether it's the creation of jobs or the incentive to have health insurance for one's employees. And that's that you have to overcome the costly consequence of providing rewards for actions which are already occurring or are likely to occur. I mean, why provide incentives for something that is already happening or going to happen? And in fact, we're looking at a projection of a gain of 24,900 private sector jobs in the coming calendar year. How many of those would occur in workforces with fewer than 100 workers, I don't know, but assuming a large number would, we'd be rewarding most of those already projected employment increases with a tax credit that we think ought to be reserved for job growth that's not otherwise projected to occur. And another way of looking at this is, for every one of the jobs that a policy like this would help to create, how many jobs are you paying for that are already being created? 10, 20, 30? Probably magnitudes like that, which makes this an extremely costly and cost-ineffective way to target a policy towards job creation, especially when we're in an environment right now where revenue losses on the general fund side are quite sensitive. We're trying to rebalance the budget here rather than create more problems down the road. Also, we'd be the last to criticize an attempt to influence market forces. And a lot of times we want to do that for the good. But when you create policies that attempt to influence market behavior, you have to be careful of unintended consequences. I think you've already heard testimony about some of the features of this bill, which could create opportunities for gaming the system. You know, if there's no doubt that a employee who has more dependents and therefore pays less taxes, has less withheld, would generate less of a tax credit for an employer, especially in that very small employment situation, one or two employees, and looking at who else you might hire, than one who has no dependents and is paying more taxes. It's also the case, I think, as already noted, that you're dealing with businesses which right now, if they're not earning a profit, are not paying a tax. And so if there's no tax credit available because you're not making a profit, there's no incentive. And maybe some of those are the businesses who most need incentives. Further, whenever you create a base period, as Representative Chambers pointed out, no matter how you define it, you're going to open yourself to manipulation where it might make sense for an employer to hold up hiring one quarter in order to hire the next. I don't think there's any easy way to get around that. And also, when you try and correct problems, as you did by targeting this to employers with fewer than 100 employees, what if you're an employer who's got 95 employees right now? You'd like to add 10, but maybe you'll stop at 99 in order to make sure you get the credit. So all these things have to be thought through, but I think actually the central problem here is, how do you create an across-the-board tax policy that's going to work for job creation? I think the lessons of the last decade or so with tax policy in our state, of course, it gets more complicated, but the reason it does is because the efforts have to be targeted, as is the case with the strategic investment program, as is the case with enterprise zones. Even though most of those are targeted more at the property tax side and have more to do with capital-intensive employers than with labor-intensive employers, nonetheless, they give you an ability to negotiate case by case to make sure you're getting new jobs created here, that you're providing tax incentives, and in return getting jobs, and in some cases defined good jobs, good paying jobs, in return. And with an across-the-board approach like this, we're just worried that you're providing money to employers, in most cases, for what is already projected to happen. We are going to see something of an upturn next year. Some jobs are going to be created by market forces, and it just is too expensive and we think unjustifiable to provide incentives for something that's already supposed to happen.
Okay. Members, questions? Tim? Tim, in the targeting is something we've talked about. The administrative issues in around trying to target for maybe potentially thousands of small employers. I guess you're talking enterprise zones, and like right now Georgia Pacific's trying to, in Halsey, the Halsey Mill, which my farm is right across the road from, is trying to become attached to the Sweet Home enterprise zone because they want to expand there. And they're looking for that property tax credit as a reason for them to expand and hire a lot more jobs. Some pretty darn good jobs. My friends work out there. And that's something you can give a lot of time and attention to. That's a really big deal. But the hypothetical espresso stand I was talking about, how do we get around not creating a disincentive for them to even apply for this thing? Because we would have to try, if you're trying to target that, and it kind of gets back to this issue I was talking with, relating to you, Representative Hobson, was we don't necessarily just want to give somebody a tax credit for a job that they were going to rehire anyway or hire anyway. We're looking to give people an incentive for a new job over and above what we're forecasting is kind of where we're trying to go with this thing. So we wouldn't want to create too much, though, and I guess that's my concern about being too targeted is would we then and actually create a disincentive in your mind because there would be so much paperwork to have to work through to get to that point?
Well, Chair Krupp, probably every employer is a little different in his or her decisions about starting or expanding a business, adding jobs. I would question whether taxes are, in fact, a disincentive to adding jobs like espresso worker jobs, when, in fact, probably the demand in the local community and the location, the ability to site your espresso stand is probably the most compelling,
probably the most
a policy-related decision. And it gets back to the meetings we've continued to have with the business community about the need to expedite siting regulations and processes. I think perhaps jobs which depend on a very localized market, usually a small retail sector, as the examples you raise, are probably most sensitive to other factors other than that personal income tax rate, by the way. You know, it's probably a sole proprietor or a partnership or S Corp, than other factors.
Okay. Well, any questions? All right. Tim, thanks. Appreciate
your
thoughts.
I just had a question.
Sure.
Sorry, Tim, a little slow on the update. So then, if we really wanted to do something dramatic to immediately jumpstart the economy and get things going, and if tax incentives and that sort of thing isn't the way to go, there are other barriers to our growth. You mentioned some of our land use regulations. We can't tackle them in a big snap hurry. What else can we do? I think that there are capital construction projects that the state needs to have done desperately. If we focused our efforts in that regard, what would you foresee in terms of a ripple effect in starting the Oregon economy?
Thank you for your question, Representative Lowe. My favorite, top of my list, and I think this keeps occurring on everybody's list when I have meetings convened by AOI and others in the business community. We have some very compelling infrastructure needs right now. Our bridges need repair. We have projects ready to go. ODOT has, I think that ODOT has plans ready to move forward. Whether the source of funding for that is there another penny or two or three on the gas tax or the vehicle registration fee, putting something like that out there and bonding it, and this is where I think borrowing makes perfect sense because you're rebuilding the infrastructure, turning a problem right now into something that would be a long-term benefit that will pay off for decades. For every $1 million you spend in on the front end of those kinds of construction projects, you're generating another 19 jobs per year, I think, is the equation. But more importantly, yes, 19. More importantly, we are then also taking this opportunity to rebuild our infrastructure and position ourselves for when market forces start to dictate more growth in our economy, that we're better positioned to maximize that growth as well as the employment opportunities that flow from it.
So put a stake rates on it for me and tell me what your prediction of the immediate short-term project, short-term consequences for the whole state of beginning such projects are, and then, say, 5 years out, short-term and long-term?
Well, short-term, we'll see construction building boost, a boost in payrolls for those workers and related payrolls as the money flows through the economy. We'll also get the benefit of rebuilding our infrastructure, which is getting to the point now with the real negative in, I believe, in calculations that some companies are making about whether to locate or expand in Oregon if you don't have a good transportation system. It's so basic. We need to make sure that whatever we're doing in whatever form of economic growth we're preparing for in the future, that our infrastructure is well developed and we're in an opportune place to take advantage of it.
It's a very good point. And Representative Lowe, there are some folks who are talking about perhaps bringing that concept to this committee for consideration here. It's a very, very serious issue. I've sat on transportation for two sessions now, and this problem is getting worse, and we've got no money to fix it. Irrespective of what our opinions are about the efficiency of ODOT, which in my opinion is doing a better job every day in becoming a more efficient, more responsive agency, this problem's going to be dealt with because it's going to cost us a lot of money in a lot of ways in the coming years if we don't do something relatively soon. So, as chair of the committee, I'm willing to entertain that, and I have the carte blanche from the speaker to do so. So we'd be happy to entertain those thoughts also.
Thank you, Chair Krupp. We would applaud that effort.
Great. Thank you.
So would you need that in the form of an amendment to this bill? I noticed the relating clause on this puppy is right open.
I would prefer to take that up as separate legislation. I think that's got some potential. We ought to be looking at that in some form.
Maybe our transportation bill.
I'm sure Representative Starr, in fact, I had a conversation with him about this last night, and I know he's was chatting with Bruce Warner, Director of ODOT, today to look at if, in fact, we were able to get something accomplished somehow out of for bonding for this bridge repair issue, if we could, in fact, how much work could we get on the ground going immediately? Because if you're selling bonds, there's a time lag there, so when you prepare the bond sale, and you get it done. However, we think we can borrow from the transportation fund in the meantime, which they sort of do for other things anyway, and get the work started. Now, the question is how many of those projects that they've identified can we get to work on today if we have the money? And I know they've identified some. In fact, there's a commission, I think, isn't that right, Representative Brown? There's a commission that's looking into prioritization of those bridges.
Yeah. So, and they do it by route, and you know, in place of fixing one bridge here and you got five of the problem, then going somewhere else to fix it, and you fix both problems.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I have a particular willingness to take a look at that issue in this committee if someone's willing to move that forward. My focus is this particular piece of legislation because it was my brainchild, I guess, for lack of a better term. All right, Harvey Matthews, please come forward, and Joe Gillian, you're up on deck. Unless you guys, look, if you guys want to come up together, feel free. That's fine. Okay. I guess I should have extended that invitation with Tim. But welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Sure. Whoever would like to start first, Harvey, you're on the list.
Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. Our membership includes about a third of Oregon's industries, and Oregon businesses laid off 175,000. Or there are 175,000 people unemployed currently. That's a crisis figure. We have the highest unemployment rate in the nation, which we're kind of getting used to hearing. But if we were to hear that, you know, we have the highest number of one-armed babies born in the nation, we'd get on top of that and we'd do something about it. Unemployment rates are directly tied to the income of an industry, and taxes take away income from an industry, and therefore I think your tax credits will encourage unemployment or the unemployment rate. It's not an ill-conceived idea at all. It's going to create jobs. It's going to stimulate the economy. Criticisms of this so far have been that we have had our businesses lose jobs across sectors, and they're going to be bringing them back anyway. that's not necessarily the case. We don't live in a closed universe. There are jobs that are lost that are going to be lost for the long term. And unless we send a clear statement to Oregon's business community that we are going to implement policies that support them, I hesitate that, well, I think those jobs will be lost forever. Projected jobs, like projected revenue, looking out, is based on models that try to predict the future, and as we know from our current economic situation, those models aren't always an accurate reflection of what happens. I think anything we can do will be a positive influence, and we should not consider projected jobs birds in hand. It's also going to say that there's going to be people cheating on their income tax returns. That does happen. The longer we discuss it, I think you guys have come up with some interesting ideas to avoid that. Strict rules, good directions, and clear consequences are key to avoid that, and you are doing everything it takes to get to that point. And lastly, the tax credits not being able to help those companies not profiting. I think the idea that they could be applied over a multi-year term is a really good way to fix that problem. So in conclusion, I think with the continuous implementation of the ideas that have been generated here, this idea has the potential to create jobs and stimulate the economy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Gilliam. I represent the Oregon Grocery Industry Association. We have some of the largest employers in the state in our group. Representing everything from manufacturing to wholesale to retail. We like the concept that you've been talking about today. You've gone a lot further than the original bill. I'll make a couple comments on some of the discussion here just to clarify some of your questions, I believe, as you talked about the structure of the bill. One, you need to separate payroll tax versus income tax. Employer will pay income tax on their income, but they're not, even though it's income tax on the employee, they pay a payroll tax every quarter. So you need to separate those two things. Profit versus nonprofit was brought up. A nonprofit can still take advantage of this bill because they're paying a payroll tax on their employee. Okay? They don't have a income tax to pay per se unless they go beyond the parameters of their charter. Once you go beyond the parameters of your charter, you're taxed at the highest corporate rate. So you can be taxed even though you're a nonprofit, depending on what the activities are that year. So what you're really getting is a break on your quarterly payroll taxes. So you meet whatever requirement you would pick, if it's 40 hours or 52 or whatever, and you finally qualify for the tax break. Let's say your payroll taxes have been $10,000 every quarter. Whoever you hired, whatever you took, let's say you got a $600 break at the end of the year, you would just pay $9,400 on your next payroll tax. So it's not going to be a break off your personal income. It's going to be a break off that quarterly. So nonprofits could take advantage and lower their costs and hire people so you still have the same effect that you're looking for if you're trying to bring people on. Number of dependents, Representative Brown brought up. You were right on the money. I don't think Dexter caught the whole upshot of your question. Yes, it would be different because that's not going to be evened out in the end until they file their tax returns and whatever they pay directly to the government is going to be off the books in terms of the quarterly tax statements you're making, the employer's making. So there would be a difference. Now, could we game the system and say, well, I'm only going to hire single people versus people with a family? You can't ask those questions in the interview process anyway. So it'd be very difficult to game, and the incremental gain for the employer is very little. You wouldn't want to get involved in that kind of process. I mean, the money, kind of money to worry about. But we're concerned about, I think, with the amendments addressed, no matter what you do, I think Tim brought up a good point in that you don't want to try to give incentives to jobs that are already coming in. Walmart, for instance, is going to build 17 stores. They already have three here in the state by the end of 2004. Very large company. They're going to hire 1 million people in the next 5 years. The target is to retain 800,000 if they're going to have a 20% turnover rate. they're hiring and they plan on doing it, is going to, you're going to hire more than the population of Rhode Island or the city of San Antonio, and they will have 600,000 more employees than the United States Armed Forces all put together. They're going to do that anyway, whether we do a bill or not. If you don't have some parameter targeting this to your smaller businesses and your Oregon businesses, you're going to be giving away citizen tax dollars to jobs that are going to come here anyway. And I don't think that's really the goal of what you're trying to do here, is to give that away. I got to tell you, it speaks to really the problem at hand, and the issue here is not necessarily tax breaks. It's a matter of capital. What do I have to spend, whether I'm a business or an individual out there? If it's a business, you have the capital, you can expand, you can hire people. In this economy, what's happened is Walmart has gone from, their earnings went from $1.6 to $2 billion. That's a 25% gain in the last year during this economy. The economy's been very good for a large company like that. And the reason is they're a discounter. So what happens? People earn less money. They're on unemployment. They look for a better value. They go to the cheapest price they can, regardless of that wage structure, that benefit structure, whatever that employee's offering, because it's an issue of capital. It's the same thing in the business community. So whatever you do here, as you start talking about it, I think Representative Brown was on it, you got to incentive to increase payroll. Otherwise, you aren't generating anything. Now, how do I do that? What gets me the incentive to do that? Can I borrow capital at a lesser rate than I could in the open market? And it's a great time to borrow right now, 6%, 5.5%, 5.25% in bonds. I really like what the gentleman from Oregon Economic Development had to say. Maybe there's a way to incentivize them to give lower interest loans to small businesses to either buy equipment for people to run or to create jobs right out in the retail community. That puts people on the map. That makes the commitment into expansion, not just the gaming we've been talking about. So you really, I think you're going the right way, but you got to hit on those things because it is all about capital. And I'll just say, you know, we're talking about 24,000 jobs, Tim brought up, Harvey brought up. That's not a prediction if you don't raise income taxes. We're all talking about how do we incentivize business, how do we give money back, how do you give them capital. Well, don't tax them. Don't increase taxes right now. Don't do a surcharge. It's absolutely crazy for us to talk about a 3 or 4% income tax surcharge and then say, but we're going to give you back a minute percentage of that to create jobs. We're chasing our tail. It fights against economic principles. So I realize the political energy that's in this building right now, but you know, really it's just working against yourself. If you're going to take the money away on one side, have less income in the economy, more income in government, less spending at the store, driving more people to the big discounter at a lower wage rate. I mean, it's a downward spiral that you can't get out of by raising income taxes. It just doesn't work. So you got to think in terms of capital, not just, you know, people gaining the system. How do you make people commit to the business? If it's buying equipment, great. Hiring people, great. But I think Representative Brown was really on the money when you talk about what's the actual incremental increase in payroll, taxable payroll. Otherwise, you don't get anything as representatives of the state, and we don't get anything in our businesses because they're not growing.
Good point.
You know, I agree with everything you said, and I have a little bit of concern in that, you know, this committee may have a 48-hour life, and that to accomplish the things that you're talking about, that's really ideal macro tax policy for a state. And I'm not sure we can put all those pieces together, you know, as quickly as that. A specific question comes to about, let's call it 25,000 jobs that the AFL-CIO mentioned a minute ago. And my understanding is that's net jobs. But we have normal turnover within the economy.
Mm-hmm.
There could be, let's say, another 100,000 or $150,000, you know, jobs out there that, you know, company A goes broke and company B gets, you know, started up. And so, you know, people end up leaving one company going to another. And, you know, if we have 25,000 net jobs, but we actually have turnover 150,000 jobs in there, the revenue impact of what's out there in terms of the number of jobs that qualify under the growth provisions that we're trying to deal with here. Understanding we're not trying to cover what's going to happen anyway, but if there's, you know, 25,000 jobs that are going to happen anyway, but 150,000 jobs out there that are kind of turnover type jobs, just because, you know, one company didn't make it and another company did, but they qualify, then if you're looking at doing a tax credit out there for a large number, like 150,000 jobs, you know, then that could take this revenue, you know, from my guess on $25,000 jobs would be like a $17 million tax credit. But if you ended up with more like 150,000 jobs out there, that could be like 80, 90, 100 million, you know, in revenue. I'm not saying that's a fact, but if we have the normal turnover of jobs out there that starts having impact in there, that's way past the scale of, you know, what we're probably prepared to deal with. And I'm not saying that's a fact, but I'm kind of concerned about those naturally turning over jobs, not just the net increase job.
Mr. Chair, Resident King, I think what you're saying is actually a good potential of happening. We were just discussing, wouldn't the 40-week limit preclude that? But going from job to job, no, you're right. I mean, if Freightliner shuts down, oh, I guess it did. You got 270 jobs out there. Now I hire them as an incremental increase, or those 270 jobs get rehired someplace, and all those businesses qualify for the credit. You didn't have a net gain in jobs, but you did give away an incentive to hire them. Is it as much impact as you want in terms of achieving net jobs? No, but you are keeping those people off the unemployment, and you're getting half a loaf. At least you're keeping them out of the hole, but you haven't created a new job to get into the 25,000 net. So I think that is something to think about in terms of, it's not good or bad, I guess. It's, you know, you kind of tread in water, keeping your head above it. It's better than increasing unemployment rate, I guess.
Right. And if we have a million jobs out there, there's probably 100,000 that turn over every year at least.
Yeah. Walmart's suggesting they can retain 20%. So they're pretty good at numbers. You know, I wouldn't question those. I would say that it's probably 20% of the workforce is turning.
Joe, do you have any idea what the numbers are for your industry, the grocery industry, in terms of turnover? Just curious.
You know, it was really varied in the last few years. When the economy was strong, we couldn't hire people. I mean, there wasn't enough people to hire. 96, 97, 98, almost zero turnover. I mean, very few. I mean, very, very low percentages. We have good starting wages. We have good compensation packages, good jobs to be in. Right now, we've had to turn people over because of the consolidation of the market, better competition, increasing costs. We're a 1% business. So, you know, for dollar and profit, we got to sell $100 in groceries, and that's the way it works. So we've seen a huge, not traditional turnover where people just leave the job, but in layoffs, we've had to do quite a bit in order to maintain a profitability at any level. That's the thing, you know, look about what we're trying to do, and you raise income taxes, we don't have much profitability we slice off because everything's about volume. So we have to go to our number one cost. Number one cost is labor cost. I mean, we're still a labor-intensive industry. People stack shelves. People bring the checks in. And so there's not much place to look. So really the burden either goes on cutting people or goes on less spendable income for the employee. There's just not much room to go to move in there. That's how most retail businesses are at this point. So the turnover is an issue, but I think your bigger issue here is how you're delivering the capital for expansion. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because if the incentive to not only just hire someone, it's the incentive to, in my hypothetical espresso stand,
mm-hmm.
To decide to buy grilling equipment and offer lunch, you know, quick sandwiches on the quick grills, that kind of thing. Well, where are you going to get the money to do that, to buy the grills? They're not cheap, so on and so forth. So you need the capital, you need the incentive to do that, in addition to hire the employee.
Mr. Chair, I think you're right on the button. You're right on the button. Because once you make that investment, you're not gaming the system because you bought the $2,000 grill, got the permit, made the alterations, done the thing, but now you got to hire someone who knows how to cook behind that thing. They kind of go hand in hand.
Question for you on do you think that this ought to be, this whole idea, concept ought to be structured so that instead of applying for a year-end credit, that maybe you just get the opportunity to deduct on your quarterly payroll tax payment? What do you think is most advantageous for business, for what we're trying to do here?
I think it's more advantageous to do it each quarter. However, when you want to put, and I'm not against saying you need 40 weeks or 26 weeks or whatever the trigger is to make sure it's a real job. If you take it in the first quarter and you take it in the second quarter and you're going into the third quarter and something bad happens in your business to lay somebody off, now you're going to have to pay back the tax credits you took in the first place. You may have less cash flow, less capital, and so the third quarter payment comes up and you got to make it up. And instead of your tax payment going down, you got to pay back what you didn't qualify for. And you may have people have a tough time coming up with the cash on hand to make that quarterly payment. So I think in a practical sense, you have to make the advantage at the end of the period, whatever it is. If it's 26 weeks, you'll get it in the third period. If it's 40, you're going to get it really in the next year. And then you get your break. Now, that doesn't throw cash flow in your business today, but if you're stable enough and you can wait for that savings, you put somebody on. A lot of businesses are just going to be simply it out.
But why is it that if you don't qualify, continue to qualify, you have to pay back? Is that part of the statute?
Well, the way I read the bill is you have to make that 40 consecutive weeks.
Right.
So let's say I'm buzzing along, got a great employee. I'm in the 36th week and I lose my best customer. I have to let somebody go. Well, it's probably going to be that last person I hired. I let them go. Now I didn't make 40 weeks, but I've taken at least a quarter of the incentive. Now I don't qualify. I assume I have to pay it back. I mean, I don't know that I could take it without qualifying.
Okay, and so if you shortened it to 6 months, and that's two quarters, then it ends, there would have to be some auditing, and then it starts over again for the next 6 months, because this whole bill is intended to be for 1 year.
Yeah. Well, if it was for 26 weeks or 6 months period, you would then qualify for the rest of the year. So you make it for the first two, you take the incentive for those first two quarters, and then you take the next third and fourth quarter incentives. But you got to get past the trigger. So wherever you set that trigger, that's how it's going to affect your when you get the break. And there's been different discussions. I can't tell you what the right number is of weeks. I mean, I think there's arguments on both sides.
Additional questions of Joe, members? Thank you.
You're welcome.
JL, welcome.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm JL Wilson with NFIB. In the interest of time, I'm just going to wrap up and say we support your proposal. I think it will have a positive bearing on our employment rate. I don't want to diminish what's already been said because from Mike to Tim to my co-presenters, you have a very thorough understanding of the parameters you have to place around the bill to make it work. So I'm not going to beat that to death. You know it, and I'm just going to wrap it up.
Okay.
And say we support.
There was there was some discussion earlier, gentlemen, about possibly capping, or maybe not discussion earlier here in committee, but at least a thought that was brought to me about capping the amount of money. What do you think about that as a methodology of keeping it cleaner, easier to administer?
Mr. Chair, capping what amount of money?
The amount of money that could be rebated to an employer.
Per employer?
Yeah, under this program, or maybe per employee. And I'm throwing things out here because again, this is still very much in the talking stage here.
Mr. Chair, the business arguments notwithstanding, it would seem to me that you might want some certainty as to the fiscal impact of the statement, and to the extent that that helps you politically, I would say that it might be in the best interest of the bill's survivability that you implement a cap. shared views, JL, and it may be kind of a natural selection process where really only the smaller businesses would look at it. If it's, you know, amounts to 5 employees, smaller companies are going to look at that versus a company that has, you know, 3 stores, 4 stores with 90 employees apiece that still qualify, but they look at the 5 and say, well, you know, economy of scale is not worth doing.
Right.
So you get more on JL's folks than perhaps Harvey's or some of my folks. I kind of have them all over the board, so
yeah, right.
I'm a hybrid.
Well, what about the idea that, and it might have been Tim Nesbitt that brought this up, and I thought it was a pretty good point, actually, is that if you have 95 employees, and we're talking about 100-person cap here to qualify, and maybe you want to go ahead and make a significant expansion, and you want to go to 105, how should we address that in your mind? Because, I wouldn't want that to be a disincentive not to hire people.
Mr. Chair, it seems a very easy solution would be to cap the number of employees that, based on your employment in the year 2002. Therefore, if you had under 100 employees in 2002, you can go up to 105 in 2003 without penalty.
Make sense to you guys?
That seems like a
good go.
You could cap the total growth on percentage, so there's in the scan that I had 95 this year, and I'm going to have 295 because I'm opening a new plant or something. You know, I just doubt that's going to happen, but I think
yeah.
That's probably a good, you know, if you're underneath the limit in 2002, you qualify.
Okay.
You're getting down a very few number, and when you get that high at that border of 95 to 100, you're only talking about, let's see, 90% of businesses have less than 25 employees.
Right.
You know, I get nine big numbers here.
As a practical matter, I mean, as a businessman, I would have to think that if I'm at the 95 employment level, that's a significant number of people. It's a significant payroll. That means something you're engaged in is fairly major. And if your business model entails that you're going to make a major investment and hire 10 more people, then your disincentive may not be the incentive that triggers that investment. You may have already figured out in your normal business model that you need to do this because market forces or whatever. It isn't to say that this wouldn't be a fair incentive to offer you, but it would seem to me that this whole concept really works better with the smaller employers, frankly. And that's kind of why we decided to kind of limit it the way we did, but also because we really want this to impact positively Main Street. As many small businesses, employers that they are out there, those are the ones that we do business with in our local communities. And I'm from rural Oregon, and have a circumstance right now where I have a lot of folks in Lebanon very concerned about the proposed new Walmart store, because a lot of my friends own businesses on Main Street there, and they don't want to be hurt by this thing coming in there. And I want to help them be able to survive and prosper in some way. So if this helps them expand so that they are able to better compete, then that's kind of where I'm trying to go with this thing. I think that's our potential. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And
sure.
One question, Deborah, did you have some additional thoughts that maybe you want to share with us in terms of some information we've talked about here quickly before we get out of here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I just wanted to be sure that people understood how the credit is set up in this bill. It is an income tax credit available to individuals or to corporations. So a person operating an espresso stand as a sole proprietor would be able to claim an income tax credit when they filed their return, their 2003 return, in April of 2004. Similar for a corporation that operates on a calendar year, they would be filing that 2003 corporate return in April of 2004, and they would be claiming a credit against their corporate tax at that time. The measure of the tax is the withholding that's paid to the state by the employer. That withholding is not the employer's tax. It is not a liability of the employer. It is collected from the employees, held in trust, and then submitted to the state. So that number that withholding amount is what's used as the basis of the credit. It may have absolutely no relation to the tax liability that those employees incur on the wages. And that's where we get to Representative Brown's point about having different numbers of dependents. I could claim 10 dependents and have low withholding, and my neighbor could claim one dependent and have high withholding. If we're both working for the same employer, those withholding amounts go into the employer's calculation of the credit. And that's where I talked about being able to change the amount of the credit by the employees adjusting their withholding amounts. So I simply wanted to be clear about those two distinct things. Okay?
What changes if we go away from withholding to total payroll, in your mind? How does that change?
I think payroll is a better thing to use. It's simpler to calculate, plus it's less susceptible to those differences. You're paying someone a wage. You're reporting that to the state on a payroll form. Actually, you're reporting total payroll to Oregon as well. If you're a corporation, you have factors that you use. One of those factors is payroll in Oregon. So even large corporations would be reporting to us the amount of Oregon payroll. That might be something that you want to use as a basis for corporations. A sole proprietor is deducting wages on their Schedule C, so they have a wage expense amount. They're also reporting, as I said, on those combined forms, and they file those quarterly. That's another figure that you might want to use. You might consider looking at requiring that to qualify for the credit, you actually have to have an increase in employees from 02 to 03, but then you base it on the amount that's shown on that quarterly report as wages. And if the number of employees go from 10 to 12, then you take the bottom two employees on that quarterly report, their wages, multiply it by a percentage, that's your credit. That might be another way to do it. In that case, you're actually looking at the payroll and perhaps getting closer to the liability those employees might incur for tax on that payroll. Maybe not. They may have other losses that offset that, but I think payroll is probably a better way to go, and Representative Lowe talked about actually trying to get to job increases. You could look at the number of employees that increased from 02 to 03 as a measure there. But I think withholding is really not connected to the liability that's incurred by those individuals necessarily. It may be a totally different number.
Okay. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Anyone else like to say anything? With that, thank you all very much for being brave enough to stay and get representatives up.
Is the Revenue Department working on impact statements sometime?
Yes.
So we get some sort of...
We hope to have that sometime tomorrow, late morning, and I need to check and see what our schedule is for floor tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, what is our prognosis for viability beyond 48 hours? I don't want to turn into a pumpkin.
Well, frankly, my sense is, Representative Lowe, that in my conversations with speakers, that probably we're going to be here through the weekend.
Yep.
So my guess is, I tend to work fairly quickly on this, if possible. But my guess is we're going to have more time than we think. Deadline. So that's my sense of it. Anyway, with that, thank you all, and we are adjourned for the evening.